I do have the pleasure of introducing our speaker today, Marci Agee, and the topic is Virginia safety today and tomorrow. And she's from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, and I can't think of another organization that has done more to improve automobile safety than the Institute. Ms. Agee received her PhD from the University of Virginia in philosophy. Prior to that, she received her bachelor's degree from Wake Forest University in history. And what she's going to talk about today is not only, as John talked about, the future of automobiles and self-driving and autonomous, but also how the Institute has improved automobile safety and what they have done to push the manufacturers to improve the safety of their vehicles as well as for regulation. The Institute was originally founded and still funded by insurance companies, which have a reason for pushing highway safety. So without further ado, let me introduce Dr. Marci Agee.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here today and to talk with you about the Institute's work. Let me start. Oops. So the Institute is a nonprofit research and communications organization that's fully funded by auto insurers, and our mission is to save lives, prevent injuries, and reduce property damage from vehicle crashes. We also have a sister organization, the Highway Loss Data Institute, that collects claims data from our sponsors and runs analyses of it. It turns out that insurance claims information is often a great window into what's happening out on our nation's highways, that we can look at claims and spot trends. So it turns out to be a really great resource for us. We have 106 employees. We have 42 up at what used to be our headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. We have recently expanded our facilities in Rutgersville, Virginia, and so now the bulk of our employees, 64, are at our facility in Rutgersville. In 2015, we underwent a big expansion, or opened it up. You can see we have a 5-acre covered test track. If any of you have driven up on 29 North, right up when you get around the Walmart in Rutgersville, you can see the big dome. Back when it was under construction, people would drive up when they saw the arches and ask us if we were building a roller coaster in our backyard. We also added an office addition so that we could move more of our Arlington staff down here. So one of the things that we do is we rate vehicles through crash testing and to let consumers know which vehicles are the safest. We also engage in all kinds of research so that we can share this research. Now, we are not lobbyists. We're completely apolitical, but we do use our research whenever possible to try to influence lawmakers who are setting highway safety policy. And one of the biggest projects that we engage in is making sure that we communicate all of our information to consumers, because that by putting, there's nothing like putting a really horrific crash test video on TV. You might remember back in the day when we used to be featured on Dateline NBC on Sunday nights, and when some of the first crash tests were really horrible, we put an onboard camera in the vehicle to give you the perspective of being inside the vehicle during the crash. And there's nothing like a horrific crash like that to put you off buying a vehicle, and the manufacturers know that, and that's where a lot of our power comes from. So we have engaged in all kinds of research over the years. So we were the pioneers of the Click It or Ticket campaign that we helped the North Carolina organize. It was very successful at getting people to buckle up. One of our retired researchers, Alan Williams, is considered the father of graduated driver licensing for teen drivers. Back when I got my driver's license, I just went and got a learner's when I was 15, and then I got a driver's license at 16, and I could do everything. Now we take things a lot more slowly with kids, because kids, when they're 16, their crash rates are so high, and so we want to give them a more gradual introduction to driving while they get through those very vulnerable months. We are big fans of red light and speed cameras. Our research indicates that these are very effective tools at deterring bad behaviors out on the road. Our research has also led to a lot of states adopting alcohol ignition interlock laws, which I'm proud to say there is one in Virginia that requires all offenders, when convicted, even first time, to have an ignition interlock, which will keep their car from starting if they've had too much to drink and they breathe into it. We've done research, again, in conjunction with looking at automated enforcement. We've found that the best thing is to adjust the yellow light timing and then use those along with red light cameras to help cut down on red light running. We are also big fans of roundabouts, and you might notice that we've got a lot of roundabouts in Charlottesville now. People hate them when they first come because they're different, but I'll tell you what, they cut down on crashes. It's really hard to crash when you're going 15 miles an hour around a small circle. We had a study back in the 80s that indicated, you know how they put rumble strips along the sides of the road? We also had research that found that if you put a rumble strip down the center of the road, it's on a two-lane highway, which is in rural areas, which is where a lot of fatalities occur, that this can help cut down on those. We've also done studies that have shown if you paint, like I said, if anybody's familiar with the new Rio Road intersection, they've painted those big road number signs in the road, things like that. When you put signs in the road, that helps to warn people what's coming. Back in the 70s, we did a lot of research about crash fires, which led the government to issue regulations about fuel tank integrity. In the 1980s, when the automakers were fighting against the introduction of driver front airbags in vehicles, the Institute fought for this, and also U.S. insurers filed a lawsuit to try to force manufacturers to put these airbags in all vehicles, which they all are in them now. Electronic stability control is a crash avoidance feature based on the technology from anti-lock brakes. It helps to keep you from losing control of your vehicle during emergency maneuvers, and are requiring this back in earlier years to win our top safety pick award, caused manufacturers to make it standard in all vehicles much earlier than they would have if the government required that. And we also, of course, have done testing to show the importance of having strong occupant compartments in vehicles to protect you in crashes. So our research has contributed, we like to think, to the decline of crash deaths. So this is showing two different lines. One is crash deaths per billion vehicle miles traveled, which you can see has gone pretty much steadily down over the years. Motor vehicle crash deaths peaked in the between the 1950s and 1970s as more people started driving. 2014 was a great year. We had an all-time low of just over 33,000 fatalities. Unfortunately, starting in 2014, that number started to tick up. We had over 35,000 and some fatalities. We are on track from looking at 2016 to keep in that direction. So the fight has not been won yet. So one of the main things that we do is we crash test vehicles to show which vehicles are safe and which aren't. Our crash haul is designed to perform front and side crash tests. We can do a test up to 50 miles per hour of a pickup truck. We celebrated our anniversary in 2009, 50th anniversary, and one of the ways that we celebrated was this. A lot of people came into this when they heard we were going to do this, and they thought that that 1959 Chevrolet Bel Air was going to be the winner in this test. They had this idea that vehicles used to be made safer than they are today. And while that vehicle is very stylish looking, the truth is that auto manufacturers were not thinking in any kind of meaningful way back in 1959 about vehicle occupant safety. You can see in this 40 mile per hour crash that the occupant compartment completely collapsed. There was a great deal of rearward movement of the dash and the steering column in the Bel Air, and it would have been a fatality for the driver of the Bel Air, but this 2009 Chevrolet Malibu, the driver could have walked away from that vehicle in this crash. So that shows you what the occupant compartments of these two vehicles looked like after the crash. So if any of you is still driving one of these classic cars, People were very sad. This was not a collector's item by any means. I mean, it was structurally sound, but it wasn't anything great. But we took an unsafe vehicle off the road, so don't be too sad. So we give ratings on vehicle tests of good, acceptable, marginal, and poor. We look at vehicle structural performance. We look at the injury measures that we get from the crash test dummies. And we look at how well the safety belts do a good job of holding the dummy's body in place during the crash to keep it from flopping around. These are the tests that we are currently doing. We started our front moderate overlap test in 1995, and that's actually a barrier test that represents the kind of crash you saw between that 2009 Chevrolet Malibu and the 1959 Chevrolet Bel Air. We started our side impact test in 2003, our whiplash test in 2004. We started crushing roofs to test roof strength in 2009, and we started our newest front crash test, front small overlap, in 2012. So, our first test, the moderate overlap front crash test program, started in 1995. That first year, about half of the vehicles that we tested received a marginal or a poor rating. And so here you will see one of those early test vehicles, the 2001 Ford F-150, which there are still a lot of these out in the road today. Once Ford saw that poor result, they moved very quickly. Within 3 years of the 2004 model, they improved it from a poor rating to a good rating. So these are our ratings over the years from 1995 on. These ratings are, so the green is good, you know, yellow acceptable, orange marginal, red is poor. These are expressed as percentages of the total number of ratings we issued each year. And you can see for the last 5 years that every vehicle that we've put through this moderate overlap test has received a good rating. And the drivers of these good rated vehicles are 46% less likely to die in front crashes than drivers of poor rated vehicles. Unfortunately, people are still dying in front crashes in vehicles that received a good rating in the moderate overlap test. So some years ago, we did a study to look and see what other kinds of front crashes people were dying and being severely injured in. So you can see 24% is the moderate overlap, so that's the kind of crash I just told you about. Well, another 24% of these serious injuries and fatalities in good rated vehicles were happening in crashes with a smaller overlap. So what's coming up is a video that shows you a comparison between our moderate overlap test and our small overlap test. The key thing about the small overlap test is when we strike the rigid barrier with only a 25% overlap on the driver's side, the loading during the crash, or the crash forces, occur outside of the frame of the vehicle where the vehicle is strongest. So coming up is a comparison video of a moderate overlap test on the left and a small overlap test, both the 2013 Ford Escape. So we've got a good rating in this moderate overlap test, and I think a marginal or poor, and a poor rating in that. So you can see in that top here, you know, a lot of vehicles, there's really not much to protect you in a crash like that. So here you can see the yellow arrow. There's the longitudinal frame rail of the vehicle where the arrow is pointing, and you can see how the damage just skims right outside of that. So here is a comparison between the occupant compartment of a good rated vehicle after the test against a poor rated vehicle. So nobody wants to be in that one on the right after a crash. Here is coming up a video example of a vehicle in our first year of testing, the Toyota Yaris, the 2013 model, that performed very poorly in our test. So, one thing that you can see that happened there, when in many of these crashes, on impact, the steering wheel, the dash, and therefore the driver front airbag will move to the right, but the dummy's body keeps going in the same direction, which ends up being center left. And so the head will often slide to the left, right off the front airbag, and hit one of the hard structures of the vehicle. So you could see how the dummy's head and that came outside. But even in the early days of this test program. Some vehicles did well. The Subaru Forester received a good rating. You can see that the side curtain airbags deployed in that crash to work together with the driver front airbag to protect the driver's head. So coming up is a video comparing a poor rated vehicle, the 2014 Mazda CX-9, with a 2014 Mercedes ML to show you about this airbag interaction. So why didn't the side airbag deploy in the CX-9? That was an older model vehicle that had no countermeasures introduced for our test. It used to be that manufacturers would program front airbags to go off in a front crash and side airbags to go off in a side crash. Well, we started giving demerits for side curtain airbags that didn't deploy during this front small overlap crash. And so now manufacturers are programming these airbags to fire, but the CX-9 was too early to catch that. We are already seeing major improvements. We just started this program in mid-2012, and you can see that we are already approaching 75% good ratings on current model vehicles. So the manufacturers moved very quickly to make improvements once we started doing this test. And we started our side impact crash test program in 2003. So this is a 31 mile per hour crash where we use a moving deformable barrier made of aluminum honeycomb. It's on a sled and it strikes the side of a stationary test vehicle at 31 miles per hour. And the vehicle contains two smaller female dummies representing a woman around 5'1 and weighing approximately 110 pounds because that size occupant is especially vulnerable to being hit in the head during side crashes. Here is a car-to-car crash to show you the dangers involved in not having side airbags. This is a Ford Explorer crashing at 31 miles per hour into the side of a Ford Focus that doesn't have any side airbags. Ouch. The high hood of the Explorer intrudes and strikes the driver dummy's head. You can see we paint the dummy's head with grease paint, so there is a dent on the front of that Explorer with red grease paint that shows where the dummy's head was hit. And then here is our barrier test that represents that kind of crash. And so you can see that the dummy's head also strikes the barrier there. To show you the difference between having side airbags and not, this picture over on the right is a Malibu, an older one that doesn't have the side airbags. And then here is one with the side airbags. It often made the difference back when we tested vehicles with and without optional side airbags. It's often the difference between a good rating with the optional side airbags and a poor rating without the airbags. This is another test program that has been really successful. You can see the ratings improvements over the years. I looked at the ratings just yesterday. I think that the only ones, you see a couple of marginal ratings, 2017, I believe that distinction belongs to both the two-door and four-door versions of the Jeep Wrangler. Don't buy one of those. And we have a few acceptables left, but you can see that most everybody's doing well. We did a study where we looked at a group of real-world side impact crashes involving good-rated vehicles with standard side curtain airbags and found out that the driver of the good-rated vehicles was 70% less likely to die than the driver of a poor-rated vehicle. So by the end of our 2009 award year, we give our top safety pick awards, I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute. We had a record number of 94 winners. Our test programs had been so successful, and it was well over 40% of all the vehicles we evaluated for that year that had good ratings. So it said, yeah, the manufacturers have done a great job of meeting our challenges, but now it's time to raise the bar. You will see us do this every few years. We don't let the manufacturers rest on their laurels for very long before we throw in a new challenge. So for 2009, but for the 2010 Top Safety Pick Award, we introduced a test of a vehicle's roof strength because we believe it's really important to have a strong roof in the event that you are in a rollover crash. We did a study looking, we crushed the roofs of some mid-sized SUVs, and then we looked at real-world rollovers involving these same vehicles to see if there was any correlation between roof strength and injury risk. The manufacturers had been steadfastly denying there was any correlation. Well, it sounds like common sense, and it turns out that indeed, when we did our study, the vehicles whose roofs were the weakest in our study were also the ones that had the highest rates of injuries and fatalities in real-world rollovers. And in our study, the greatest benefit came from having a roof that could withstand four times the vehicle's weight before crushing 5 inches. So that's what we require to get a good rating. Now, just to give you an idea, the government standard had been that a vehicle's roof only needed to withstand 1.5 times the vehicle's weight before crushing 5 inches. They have been, for the last few years, phasing in a tougher requirement that has to be completely phased in by September of this year, where a vehicle's roof will have to withstand 3 times the vehicle's weight. So we require something tougher. We have a machine in our crash hall that lowers a plate onto the roof of the vehicle and steadily crushes it. So here is, now you have to watch, you might look like nothing's happening, but the machine's moving. You can watch on the graph. This vehicle weighs 3,998 pounds, and so by reaching a peak up there near 20,000 pounds of force, that means that the roof withstood 4.9 times the vehicle's weight before crushing 5 inches. So that gets you a good rating. These ratings have also improved very quickly, that almost everybody is getting a good rating on this. Drivers of these good rated vehicles have a 34% lower fatality risk than drivers of poor rated vehicles. One other test that we perform, we've been doing for a while, is a rear impact sled test. This is a whiplash test. Whiplash accounts for 25% of insurance payouts for injuries. When you're rear-ended, the seat back pushes your body forward, and if you're not, the head restraint isn't supporting your head and neck, they'll lag backwards so they reach a maximum point of distortion and then will snap forward like the tip of a whip. So what we want in a good head restraint is one that catches up very quickly with your head and neck to support them during a crash. And here is a video showing a good rated seat of a Honda Accord 2008 model. And you can see how quickly the head restraint catches up with the dummy's head. These ratings have also, from this program, we're on the verge, I think, of declaring this a complete success. You can see we have a couple of acceptable ratings floating around now, but most everybody's been doing well on this for a while. Good rated seats have neck injury rates 15% lower than those in poor rated. The government is now also requiring this kind of performance from head restraints, and so that's why I think at some point we might get to the point where we decide that this battle is won and we will move on. So as I said, every year we give a top safety pick award to vehicles that do well in all of our tests. And this is one of the ways that we influence the manufacturers. The manufacturers love using these awards in their advertising. So it's a great carrot for them. If we dangle that out there, it's what causes them to make these improvements really quickly. And many of them have found they get substantial sales boosts when they advertise vehicles as award winners. It's the best way, if you were to ask me, what's the safest vehicle I can buy? I'm not going to tell you which one is the safest because we don't do that. I can tell you within each class of vehicle which ones did well on our tests. So it's just a measure of all of our tests to show you which vehicles we think are the best. So we just announced our 2017 award winners in December. To get our highest award, I'll start with the bottom one. To get the top safety pick award, you need to get a good rating in all 5 of our crashworthiness tests. So 2 front, side, roof strength, and head restraint tests. And you need to get an advanced or superior rating for front crash prevention, which basically means that you have to get those ratings for auto braking, and I'll tell you more about that. To get our highest award for 2017, the Top Safety Vic Plus, you have to do all of that, and you have to get a good or acceptable rating on our new headlight test that I'll tell you about in a little bit. So this is, I think, again, the best measure. If you want to, if you're thinking about buying a new vehicle, please go to our website, ihs.org, and look at our winners. There now, it used to be that the winners were just among luxury cars, but now the manufacturers, because of this testing, have made more and more moderately priced vehicles safe. And so you have a much larger choice. And indeed, We hope that we've changed the way you think about buying cars. It used to be when people went out to buy a vehicle that the first thing they thought about is, oh, is it pretty? What color is it? Does it have a lot of horsepower? Is it sporty? Now we hope that the first question that most everyone is asking about a vehicle is it safe? So, moving on to the future. The future is now in some respects. You have probably not been able to miss over the past few years that there has been a lot in the news about distracted driving and specifically against texting while driving. We all know that driving distracted is really dangerous, and yet a lot of us still do it. AAA Foundation did a survey of drivers in 2010 where they asked them their opinions about cell phoning while driving and texting and emailing while driving. And so 92%, I believe, of survey respondents said that texting and emailing while driving were a terrible idea, but then 24% admitted to having done one of those things at least once in the past month. So if you'll see, there's a little overlap there between the percentages, and someone was being a hypocrite. Regarding cell phone use, nearly two-thirds of survey respondents said that they felt personally endangered when people in vehicles around them were talking on a cell phone, but then slightly over two-thirds of survey respondents admitted to having used a phone, and often handheld, in the past month. It is very hard to change driver behavior. So we decided to put our eggs in the basket of equipping vehicles with technology that can step in and help us out when we're doing dumb things while we drive. So our newest program, you might not think of this as a crash avoidance program, but it really is a feature, is we're evaluating headlights. Almost 17,000 annual crash deaths happen during dusk and dark and dawn. And there are fewer crashes when you have good lighting and can detect obstacles. Federal standards, again, allow for a lot of variances that make it hard to standardize how headlights perform. We started our headlight testing last year. We test low beams on five approaches. You can see here a straightaway, slight curves to the left and right, sharper curves to the left and the right. We also evaluate the amount of glare. We want to make sure the headlights aren't giving off so much glare that they might impair the vision of a driver coming in the opposite direction. We give a bonus if a vehicle has high beam assist. I don't know about you, but I hardly ever use my high beams, even when I really ought to use them, because I'm so afraid of shining them in somebody's eyes. Well, a lot of vehicles now come with high beams that they will sense when you can safely turn them on, and will turn them on, and then once it detects headlights coming in the opposite direction, it will turn them off. So this shows you the little thin blue and white marks are no demerit lines, blue low beams, white high beams. So this is our first ratings release last year. We only had one good rated vehicle, a Toyota Prius V. So pay attention coming up. So the BMW 3 Series received a marginal rating, and the Honda Accord, where is that on the list? I think got an acceptable. Okay, so this is the range of the BMW 3 Series halogen lights, the low beams. This is the range of the Prius V that got a good rating. High beams, BMW 3 Series, Toyota Prius. A video showing you the difference. You can see how that the Prius V's lights are lighting various parts of the road better than the 3 Series. And one thing that we found with these, a lot of vehicles have these very expensive headlight packages, and you'd think that they would be better, but often cases they're not, that sometimes the least expensive packages are better. What we are trying to do is to encourage the manufacturers to stop having so many options with headlights and just to, you know, find a good rated headlight and just slap it on all of their vehicles. This might be of interest to you. Living in Virginia, so that Honda Accord did a much better job of revealing that deer up ahead than the Mercedes C300. So in our test, what we're doing is we are measuring the distance that headlights illuminate the road at an intensity of 5 lux. So a lux is a unit of aluminum, so we're casting light on a surface. To give you just an idea, a full moon on a cloudless night has a 1 lux intensity. So there, that's showing you that a cord is lighting 270 feet at 5 lux, and you can see there really is a nice advantage there. So here are our headlight ratings for 2017. You can see that this is something that the manufacturers have a long way to go. We've only got 7 vehicles that received a good rating, 40% acceptable. Well, you know what? That's going to change really quickly. Why? Because we added this requirement to get our good or acceptable headlight rating for our 2017 Top Safety Pick Plus award. So the manufacturers, you better believe it right now, are scrambling to improve their headlight ratings so they can keep up with these awards. So our first crash avoidance feature that we started rating 2013, front crash prevention. So these, we have a fairly fine-grained rating scale. We give 1 point if a vehicle comes equipped with forward collision warning, and then we give points based on how much a vehicle either slows down or if it comes to a complete stop in 12 and 25 mile per hour tests out on our test track. And we use a balloon car target that's painted like the rear end of a vehicle. So the next this video is going to show you the wide ranges in performance of why we have to have these fine-grained ratings. So you can see that some of the vehicles are showing you the speed reductions there. The Subaru Outback with its EyeSight system, which are stereoscopic cameras around the, on either side of the rearview mirror, you can see it's the only one that it stopped in both tests. So here are our ratings. You can see that for 2017, we've got more superior rated vehicles. To get a superior rating, a vehicle has to have substantial speed reductions or come to full stop in both tests. To get an advanced rating, the vehicle has to have earn at least, I think, 5 points in one of the two tests to get an advanced rating. Our research indicates that front crash prevention is already reducing rear-end crashes. So forward collision warning, that's where the vehicle senses when you get too close to a vehicle in front of you and will give you an audible warning to let you know you need to put on the brakes. 27% less likely to rear-end another vehicle with that. When coupled with auto brake, where the vehicle senses when you get too close to the vehicle in front of you and it actually applies the brakes to either slow the vehicle down and mitigate the severity of the crash or to prevent it altogether, 50% less likely. We were happy early last year to announce in conjunction with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that we had negotiated a voluntary agreement with 20 automakers representing virtually all of the private passenger vehicle market in the U.S. to make auto brake standard on all of their features by the 2022 model year, which is about 3 years ahead of when any federal regulatory effort could achieve the same effect. There are other kinds of systems that we are not yet evaluating. We don't really have a lot of data on whether they work or not. So lane departure warning, lane keep assist, blind spot detection, park assist, and backover prevention, fatigue warning. One thing that we do know works, backup cameras. Our research has shown that backup cameras do cut down on crashes. The government is going to require backup cameras in all new vehicles in 2018. So the next question, we're all hearing about autonomous vehicles in the news all the time, and it makes it sound like they're going to be here tomorrow. Here are some headlines with manufacturers, Google, projecting when they are going to have autonomous vehicles available. Autonomous vehicles would be great because 94% of crashes are due to driver error. So if we could take the human out of the equation, we could make our roads a lot safer. But, a lot of buts on this topic. The insurance data is showing that some of these features aren't as effective as we'd like to think. Okay, here's one thing. Does anybody in here have lane departure warnings? Like when you go out of the lines, does it annoy you? Because, well, 70% of people who brought their Hondas into Honda dealerships for service had deactivated it. So, Again, this has implications for more intrusive features. And if you've gotten, our company car has got a million things that beep and flash lights at you and everything. And so if people are turning these off, then this has a lot of negative implications for autonomous operation and also for vehicle-to-vehicle or vehicle-to-infrastructure communications. One of the main challenges with automation is when you have systems where they can pilot the car, but then in emergencies, the driver needs to take control again. How are we going to share the road if there's a mixture of autonomous vehicles and human-powered vehicles? The Google car, most of the crashes that have happened have been people driving other cars hitting the Google car because it's obeying the law. It's going the speed limit. One of the biggest illustrations of like the problems with handoff from an autonomous system to a human being, if you remember that horrible Air France crash off the coast of Brazil some years ago, where the plane was on autopilot and all of a sudden the plane got in the weeds and the pilots had to take over suddenly and they couldn't recover from the stall. The longer that we are not concentrating on our task, the harder it is to get our attention back in case of emergencies. So, where are we today? SAE International has made this helpful chart of levels of automation, and the government has just adopted this. So, level one, driver doing everything all the time. Level zero. Level one, assistance. So this would be like maybe having a system like adaptive cruise control that can have sustained control of the vehicle's longitudinal position in the road and its speed. But that's a level one, we'll do that, but the driver still has to be fully in control. Level two automation is here. Level two would be where the vehicle is capable of taking continuous control of both a vehicle's steering and speed. So it's going to control both the longitudinal and lateral positions of the vehicle. So this would be a combination of adaptive cruise control and lane keep assist. But still, level two is not going to detect when there's a stoplight or if you need to turn or change lanes. And so the driver needs to keep her hands on the wheel the whole time to make sure that she can intervene if something bad happens. So you probably heard about the Tesla Model S fatal crash that happened last May. The Tesla, I went around and I interviewed a bunch of our engineers, and it's funny that most of them think that the Tesla autopilot system is level two. I did find one that actually thinks it's level three. Which there are no vehicles that are available right now commercially that have a level three, which is where you could actually take your hands off the wheel and that the vehicle would be able to drive under certain conditions. So part of the problem is this guy that was killed in this Tesla is he was treating the very poorly named autopilot system because it's really not autopilot. You are supposed to keep your hands on the wheel with the Tesla at all times. And they'll let you go for 11 minutes without touching the steering wheel and then it will warn you and disable the system. But anyway, this guy had put videos of himself on YouTube doing all sorts of dumb things with his hands off the wheel while he was driving. There was a rumor that the truck driver that he hit said that he was watching a Harry Potter video, but we have no corroboration that that was actually true. What happened in that crash? Well, a big tractor trailer turned in front of his vehicle, and it was the trailer was white. And the sun's hitting it meant that the vehicle's cameras didn't detect it. And so the vehicle underrode, they didn't even brake, and it underrode the trailer and then ran off the road and hit something, and the guy was killed. Of course, this is a very common type of crash with human drivers. So now Tesla, they were using cameras to detect things like that. Now they have changed the software to rely more on radar. But still, it highlights the need that the driver needs to be ready at any second to take control of the vehicle. This is why, because there's so many problems with level three, a lot of manufacturers, and the two notable ones, Ford and Volvo, and also Google, are striving to skip right from two to four, which is where under limited conditions, say on an interstate travel or something, the vehicle can pilot itself without any driver assistance. But the driver is still, if in other conditions, if you suddenly got off the interstate and onto stop and go traffic in an urban environment, then these vehicles would still have steering wheels and brake pedals and everything. Level 5 would be where the vehicle could do everything for you, and that is very, very, very far away, we think. But here are numbers of models from 2016. We don't have the 2017 counts yet from manufacturers that have some degree of automation, so usually like a level 2 automation. Just to give you an idea of all the sensors that are working on these vehicles, you have LIDAR, light detection and ranging, what's bouncing light off of things, radar, let's see, short-range radar, mid-range radar, cameras, infrared, long-range radar. These things are all detecting lines in the roads, roadside obstacles, other vehicles. So the sensors, a lot of these, the vehicles are already equipped with these because they are powering these individual crash avoidance features, and someday they'll be used for complete automation. But here's the thing. It takes a long time for a new technology to saturate the marketplace. Electronic stability control, you can see that we're not too predicted to have like 99% coverage in the fleet till the year 2050, and this was introduced first in 1995. People keep their cars on average like 11 or 12 years. So front crash prevention, again, you can see that it's gonna be a while, even with the voluntary commitment, before most of the vehicles on the road have this feature. So fully self-driving vehicles are probably years away, but there are things that we know that work right now that could help cut down on crashes. And they're very simple things. So here's one that the state of Virginia needs to hear. Enact primary belt laws. A primary belt law is where the police can stop you just if they see you, front seat passenger, not wearing a safety belt. If everybody buckled up, we could have prevented 2,800 deaths in 2014. Most of the people who die in crashes are unbelted. So there we see that Virginia still has only a secondary law right here. What does this mean practically? It means you can see Virginia has between 80 and 84% belt use, whereas a lot of these states that have primary laws are approaching 100% belt use. Talk to your general assemblyman about this.
Does everybody know what that means? Primary, secondary? They may not.
Well, so the primary, again, is where the police can stop you if they see you not wearing a seatbelt. Secondary means that if they stop you for some other infraction and see that you're not wearing their seatbelt, that you can get a ticket. There are a lot of the objections to this, so you see New Hampshire, their motto, live free or die. We like to say live free and die. That, they think that's a personal freedom thing. Well, it's not just that, because motor vehicle crash injuries and deaths cost states a lot of money. It increases your insurance premiums. Also, one unbelted passenger in the back seat of a vehicle during a crash can kill all the other belted people in the vehicle by becoming a flying projectile during a crash. So from now on, if anybody tries to sit in your car and not wear a safety belt in the back seat, tell them they can't ride with you until they buckle it. We are also big believers in motorcycle helmets. They decrease these risk of head injury and likelihood of death. So the state of Michigan, back in April 2012, rolled back their motorcycle helmet law, and they saw a predictable increase. We've been studying it over the years of more severe head injuries. By equipping motorcycles with anti-lock brakes, we could cut down on crashes. Now, anti-lock brakes have had a very spotty record on vehicles. that they, I think even to this day, they're not providing a whole lot of benefit, although the technology has led to the development of electronic stability control, which does make a huge difference. But in motorcycles, keeping the wheels from locking up is really important in preventing crashes. We can strengthen teen driver laws. Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death of 13 to 19-year-olds in the U.S., and so graduated driver licensing laws have cut down on these teen fatalities. So here's, we have a GDL calculator on our website where you can look at this. So this is the state of Virginia. And on the left, you can see where it's sort of scratched out in the gray. These are our current provisions, like permit age. And you can see that we have a slider that if you would slide it over so that Virginia would follow all these optimal provisions, you can see the reductions over on the right by percentages of fatal crashes and also collision claims. Lower speed limits. This is one of our favorite themes. Speeding is dangerous. The faster your car is going, the higher the crash forces are during a crash, the less reaction time you have. We just had a study come out last fall. Speed limit increases over the past 20 years have cost us 33,000 lives. And yet states all over the U.S. are raising their speed limits up and up and up. Use automated enforcement. Our research indicates that red light and speed cameras are very effective at deterring bad behavior. I know a lot of people hate them. You know, we used to have one at the Rio Road and Route 29 intersection. Actually, it did cut down on T-bone crashes at that intersection while it was there, but there's a real pullback now that there are a lot fewer cities that have them than had them a few years ago. In one of our studies, we saw that 21% fewer fatal red light running crashes happened in states that had red light cameras on, 14% fewer fatal crashes of all types at signalized intersections than would have occurred without cameras. So again, here's the toll. 171,000 red light running crashes, 126,000 injuries, 709 deaths. People squawk about the invasion of privacy or how unfair it all is. We want to keep the focus squarely on the victims. We think that you do not have the right to run a red light when you're going to be putting people's lives at risk. Require alcohol ignition interlocks. I'm happy to say that Virginia does require these for all offenders. When interlocks are installed in vehicles and people have to breathe into them before they drive, it disables the vehicle if they're over the legal limit, and this does cut down on drunk driving. Build roundabouts. So this is a special of special interest regarding senior citizen drivers. So many, many crashes that occur with senior citizens happen at intersections, and also when for failure to yield right of way, so say turning left in front of an oncoming vehicle. And by putting in roundabouts, we can cut down on some of those dangers involved at signalized intersections. Another thing, by the way, just that has really cut down on senior citizen crash deaths is the improvement, especially in side impact protection, that as vehicles have gotten stronger, that even if someone does make a turn in front of an oncoming vehicle, vehicles are much stronger and can protect you much more. And by the way, don't let anybody tell you that seniors are not safe drivers, because this is a myth. People think crash rates are higher than for middle-aged people, but still not as high as teenagers. And also, seniors tend to be very responsible and to self-limit their driving when they have impairments. So again, if we were to put in more roundabouts, then we could reduce all kinds of crashes around. And I'm happy to see that Charlottesville has been putting these in. And we've done surveys, and people hate them at first because they're strange and they don't know what to do with them. But after getting used to them, people love them. Same thing with red light cameras. You know, you hear a lot of people complaining about red light cameras, and yet we've done surveys, something like 74% of the respondents approved of them. So that might be another sort of disconnect. Like, same thing with the people surveyed about cell phone use, that, you know, it's, you know, we want to do it, but we don't want other people doing it. So we might like the idea of red light cameras in the abstract, but not like the idea when we get a ticket. Anyway, that's it.
her.
Fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we're going to have microphones on each side because this is podcast, so you'll need to speak into the microphone. And first question.
I have a 7-inch GPS, and it's relatively new. But the wonderful thing is it tells me I have a red light warning at places there are no red light warnings. And it's very good because I do check my speed when it comes on. And I think it would be a good thing to have those tell us to slow down, that there is a red light warning when there isn't one.
Well, as I said, some of these systems are not working quite the way they were intended to work. Yes?
I've heard some reports and description of driverless cars and autonomous cars. Is there any real difference in those two terms?
I don't think so. So Google, of course, is the most famous, I think, example of the people that they're working on the driverless car. Now, you've heard that some cities are using driverless cars with Uber or Lyft. They're driven robotically, but they still have a human being in the passenger seat. But they are designed to drive completely automated in these certain narrow conditions within the city. So I don't think there's any meaningful distinction between those two terms.
One of our previous meetings, we had both police chiefs, Charlottesville and Albemarle, and basically they said speeding, we need to educate people. If speeding is a serious problem, how on earth do you educate people, and wouldn't enforcement be a better alternative?
Yes. So one thing that our research has showed us consistently over the years is that it is very, very difficult to change driver behavior through education. One example I like to use, you might have noticed this, that back when they started all the work on Route 29 up near in front of Hollymead Town Center, VDOT put this nice lighted sign on the side of the road that says, orange cones, no phones. How many people do you think are riding down the road, talking on the phone, they look over and they see that sign and think, oh, I better put my phone away, that's dangerous. Practically no one. So the same thing, you can put billboards all over the place warning people not to speed. You can have, you know, just all kinds of public service campaigns. The problem is we just don't pay attention. There are some ways you can change driver behavior, and that, so one of those ways anyway is through using red light or speed cameras. People often criticize these. I mean, I know there have been problems with corruption in some cities that have had these, and that's a problem. We need to eliminate that. People complain they're only revenue generators. I personally don't even know that I see the problem in that. If you're breaking the law, why not donate some money to the state? But anyway, that aside, their purpose is deterrence. It's supposed to train you to slow down. We did a study in Arizona, a speed study, where we put in some speed cameras and we looked at some of the roads that had the speed cameras. And what we found is that in some surrounding roads that did not have speed cameras, the people slowed down there too. The speed cameras had a nice effect. So that's why, yeah, we agree. And there are not enough police out there. I mean, I can't tell you how many times. So I work in Rutgersville. So every day I'm driving up 29, and you might be familiar with the intersection at Burnley Station Road, which is right up at the almost the Greene County line. And this was actually one of the roads that they considered moving that red light camera when they redid the intersection at Route 29 up there. I tell you what, they need to, because at least once a week I am sitting at the stoplight, and the light will have been red for several seconds, and I will see somebody barrel through there going around 80 miles an hour. And one of our employees was almost killed at that intersection in a crash like that when somebody ran a red light, wasn't paying attention, and didn't brake. So, and I'm always like, where are the police? Nobody's ever there when I see these egregious things. So yes, that's we have basically mostly given up on trying to educate people, and that's why we want to use this automated enforcement and equip vehicles with these technologies so that we don't have to worry about people doing the right thing.
And we have a question over here, and then we'll bounce to the other.
I have a 2011 Prius, which has very poor
passenger side rear visibility. And particular function of blind spot observance. I'm wondering if there's something I could add to the vehicle that will improve that situation, or your thoughts on it.
I don't know of anything, because this is interesting. I've volunteered to participate in a study where they're going to equip my car with this mobile eye system that is an aftermarket crash avoidance thing that I think is going to, but anyway, the first question I asked, I said, is it going to give me a blind spot detection? And they said, no, it's only the forward collision warning. I don't know of anything right now that any system, and I can't swear, again, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not on the cutting edge of what's available out there, but I don't know of anything right now that you could do to improve that. What some people do, my dad ended up doing this when he got older. He put a convex mirror, a little one, just glued it. I found that, it's really hard to adjust your side view mirrors optimally. That might be worth, if you haven't, you've probably already done this, but is to test it so that you make sure that you've got continuous vision of vehicle coming along in the side up until it reaches your actual vision, in the mirror, until it reaches your visual range and have a smooth transition. It's actually very hard to position your mirrors to do this, but it can be done.
Yeah, Marcy, I want to thank you for just an amazing presentation.
Oh, thank you.
I found it to be thorough, very data-driven, and very compelling. The work that you're doing to actually persuade manufacturers of cars to make them safer and safer and safer, I'm not sure they would be doing that on their own without the independent testing. So, just on behalf of all citizens, I'm just amazed at the work you're doing that is just so great and so compelling, and all the things you've done. It's one of the best presentations I've seen in years and years. What I'm struck by, though, is as a citizen, I consider myself to be well-read and very well-informed, and I knew almost nothing that you presented. And I say shame on me for not being more informed and looking at it more. And at the same time, I look at your organization, and I say, how can your organization spread the word to more citizens about what you're doing to be able to ask these questions to get these things? Because I can tell you, when I leave here, the first thing I'm going to do is go to your website, and I'm going to read every single thing in there and probably sell our two vehicles and get something that's safer, because, it's something that I worry about a lot. Right. So that's the first point I want to make, is about how can you do more in terms of, Twitter and YouTube
video. That's one of our main strategies. We court media attention very aggressively. We are on Twitter. We're getting ready to get on Facebook. We had a little resistance. I'm not positive about that, but I'm in communications, and we are pushing, as like everybody else, all the manufacturers, all our sponsors are on Facebook, and we need to be there too. We get television coverage. We try to promote. I think we're constantly looking for ways to do this more, but we get insane television coverage whenever we have these big releases. So we might be seen in 5 million households or 50 million, I can't remember, whatever. But then we only have 100,000 visits that day to our website. So people are seeing us on TV, but then for whatever reason, they're not going to our website. We ask this question constantly, what can we do about that? Because we want to drive, because our website now is our primary way of getting the word out, and everything we've ever done is on our website. So, trust me, we are thinking about that constantly, but we can't make people pay attention. We're trying to, they're waving and everything. But
there's one additional point, sure, I want to make. One of the best things that I ever did is, because I think it's one thing to have all these, passive, yeah, devices to help us be safer. It's another thing as we as drivers to be better. And one of the best things I ever did was BMW actually has a 5-day driving school that you go to. And I went to it 20 years ago, and it absolutely changed my life about driving, defensive driving, being able to do things. And one of the things that occurs to me me as kind of a next step for your organization. If you would develop actually a driving school or have the manufacturers develop a driving school, because it was the best $1,000 that I ever spent in order to become a driver that I consider to be, you know, an example. I was out driving in the Shenandoah National Park, and a wild turkey flew out in front of my vehicle. Now, wild turkeys are very large. I was in my car with five other women at the time. We had just completed a hike. And I had a choice to either swerve and go over a cliff on Skyline Drive and kill all of us or hit that turkey straight on. I knew from that driving course that I needed to hit that turkey straight on. I would damage the car. None of us were injured at all as a result of that driving course.
This is a good tip, by the way. If a deer runs out in front of you, most of the fatalities and serious injuries that occur in deer animal strikes happen when people try to swerve and lose control of their vehicle. I don't want to be a wet blanket. We have looked at various programs like that, and they overall are not as effective as you would think. And part of the thing is sometimes they are preaching to the choir, so they're getting responsible people like you who probably would have driven pretty safely even if you hadn't taken the course. But we haven't, just in terms of our studies, seen a big reduction in crashes of people who have taken defensive driving courses. I'm not saying that they can't be good, but I'm just saying that right now the evidence is very mixed about their effectiveness. So anyway, that's the answer why you will not see us doing that, because we, you know, our resources are limited, and so we pursue things that our research shows us are really effective. So again, I'm not at all saying that these things are not worth doing. It's just that we don't have the kind of quantification that we would feel would merit our being involved.
Just a comment. A number of years ago in the school division, we changed our driver education policy requiring students to have more behind-the-wheel driving time and also requiring parents to take a two-and-a-half-hour seminar in how to teach your child how to drive. And that's had a dramatic reduction in the number of accidents, and particularly in the number of fatalities from our teen
drivers. That's what our research into the graduated driver licensing has shown us. There is no substitute for lots of on-the-road experience and firm parental guidance as teens are learning how to drive.
A question over here.
You say that you want to have more exposure. That has got to be one of the most complicated. Your logo is awful. it makes no sense in a lot of ways. And
well, that you're not going to get any traction on because our board loves it. So.
I'm a professor at the University of Virginia at a Department of Mechanical Engineering. We did a lot of research, and some professors worked with your organization. One of the things we've done quite a bit of studies on is vehicle dynamics and vehicle stability. Most people don't realize how important it is to have proper tires. For example, if you were to have radial tires up front and biased ply tires in back, you could kill yourself. Mm-hmm. I know that because I did that on a big station wagon. I did a 180 in the road, and I barely got off. I missed a school bus. And so one of the things that is extremely important is that not only do you have to have proper tire inflation, but even if you have the correct tires, if your front pressure is higher than the back, it changes the slip angle. You can skid out very easily. It's an unstable situation. The other thing that we emphasize, I got a car, we now have mirrors that are dimming. One of the problems with seniors, when they drive, as you all know, when you have a light that hits you, it takes a longer response for your eyes to respond. And so some of the newer cars, like my Audi, have automatic dimming mirrors. The Audi also has radar on the side so that when somebody's in my blind spot, the yellow light comes on. And it'll make an audible warning. I also have the speed thing that will buzz when I hit a certain limit. It's very important because I have a heavy foot. So all of these things are very important. But one of the most important things is proper tire pressure. This is critical. And if you were to take and change just the front tires on your car and not the rear, this is highly dangerous because you now have an unstable vehicle. So these are little small points that need to be emphasized. The other point, I was in New York State. We had to take driver training. And they showed us some awful, awful accidents that the parents objected to because they're so gory, but it made an impression. So if you're going to do training, it has to be done in high school. You can't wait till we get older and in our habits there. I'd like to mention, my parents, I gave them a station wagon, they cut out the seat belts.
Right. Yeah. 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 Any question on this side? Thank you. Right over there.
I have a 2014 Prius, and it is the headlights don't give adequate lighting ahead. Is there anything I can do about it?
The only thing that you might want to do is take it to the dealership and see if they're aimed correctly, because a lot of the vehicles come out of the factory with improper aim. If that's not it, But as we've seen, a lot of the headlight ratings in our tests, the vehicles perform very poorly. There are a lot of vehicles out there that just have crummy headlights. My vehicle is one of them. My low beams are terrible, and it just means I need a new car. But I can't afford a new car right now. So
we have a question on this side.
Yes, something that drives me crazy and I just simply can't understand is why, when police make an effort to catch speeders or DUI offenders, they seem to publicize that on TV and on the radio, where these little traps will be, so that people go the other way. Well, is there anything that can be done about that?
I mean, not by us. I mean, you can certainly complain to your local police departments. I mean, I think part of the problem there, again, is they're trying to deter bad behavior. But again, yeah, it does make it easy for people to avoid them. But it can also make you wonder. I mean, I might wonder if I knew that the police were doing stuff like that, I might wonder if they were also doing programs where they weren't publicizing them, because I'm paranoid that way. So maybe that's what they think is just the effect of knowing that they're out there doing it might make some people behave better.
I'm curious on the coming down on the accident rate, and it started to go back up. And have you done any correlations on gas prices and average speed driven?
I think, I don't know about the gas prices and average speed driven. Obviously, the easing of the recession, that's when the numbers started to go back up because more people were driving. We have tracked when the unemployment rate is high, fewer people drive. So I guess when people are employed and they have more money, they drive more. And what's disturbing, you know, vehicles are safer than ever, and yet these fatality rates are climbing. And so, you know, part of that is, you know, maybe people are becoming too overconfident because they think their vehicles are safe and they think that they will, the vehicle will protect you when you drive like a jerk. And as we all know, people ask us, like, why are your test speeds so slow? Why don't you do something faster? Well, you're going above a certain speed. The crash forces are so high. The vehicle can't protect you. And we chose, test speeds when we started these tests that where we could show meaningful differences that some vehicles did well and some didn't. Because that if everybody had flunked or, gotten poor ratings on our crash test in the beginning, the manufacturers would have just thrown up their hands and said, your tests are unfair, they're unrealistic, we're not going to pay any attention to you. So, but yeah, I don't know what else to say about that.
If you had the sound on those crashes, it would be much more effective.
As I was telling, you know what we have to do? We have to dub those sound. We filmed this crash test at 500 frames per second, and so they would have to dub the sound effects in, and that's we do.
The actual seeing that offset at 45 or whatever it was, like an explosion.
It is.
Question on this side.
Changing the subject a little bit, what is the visitation policy at your facility in Rutgersville?
We are sadly not open to the public.
Never.
We used to be more open to community groups, but we are open to our sponsor, the insurance companies, to government, media, and first responders are basically the groups that we allow to come. We don't allow kids. We have had a sharp uptick in the number of those groups that are coming, and we are a small working lab, and so we are just not equipped to handle that kind of volume of visitors that we would have if we opened it up to the public. I mean, I wish everybody could come, but It's just, and plus, whenever we have group schedule, we have to schedule a crash test, and sometimes we hadn't planned on scheduling a crash test, and we're trying to save money. So I think that there's actually been a real tightening of this, and I'm sorry about that. But
Who is responsible for testing the safety of software in cars? Is that left up to the individual manufacturers?
That's left up to the manufacturers as they're developing it. That's all proprietary.
So you don't see any role for the Institute in that down the road?
No, because all their systems can be so different that I don't see us getting involved. That's one thing. We show the manufacturers what's wrong with their vehicles, but we don't tell them how to fix what's wrong. Because we don't want to get into that liability thicket. We show them, it's like, this is how your car performs, and then it's up to them to try to figure out how to solve the problem. So we point the problems out, and then they have to deal with it.
It looks like you intentionally crash some really perfectly good cars. How many of them do you go through in a year, and what do you do with the wrecks?
So we generally do two high-speed crash tests a week. So that'll be our front or side crashes. We don't do them twice a week, every week. Like this January, our schedule has been very light. I would say that we probably do around 82 of these front and side crashes each year. We are crushing roofs. We are doing, we buy the seat and head restraint to do the head restraint testing. We are testing the auto braking. We do buy those vehicles. Headlights, the dealers have been very generous. They lend us the cars because we test every headlight package available. So we borrow. We have a great relationship. We're helping to prop up the local auto dealer economy because we buy a lot of cars. So we buy a lot. I mean, it's millions of dollars worth of cars that we buy every year. Any of the vehicles that are in our front side or roof strength tests are de facto totaled, whether they could be repaired or not, because we do not want them getting back out on the road. And we have a contract with a salvage company that once we're done with them, we release them to salvage. If vehicles that the auto brake vehicles, we have a lottery that employees can put into to buy these vehicles for the Blue Book value minus the damage estimate. And then if they don't go, they go get spread out wider to a network of friends and acquaintances. If they don't go then, they go to CarMax. So,
I have recently read a study that's been done that shows that by 2020, very few people will be driving their own car, that most people will be riding Uber.
That seems a little soon to me. I think it's going to be a very long time. And again, if you saw the slides talking about how long it takes for a technology from its inception to filter out widespread into the fleet, so I don't think anything like that is going to be happening by 2020. Maybe 2040. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has targeted 2046 as being the year at which they want to have zero highway fatalities. Again, it's unclear. Because as long as human beings and automated vehicles too are sharing the roads, there are going to be problems. There's going to be problems with hacking. There are going to be people who try to mess with the autonomous vehicles by weaving around them and cutting in front of them and stuff like that. And as long as we have a mix, I think it's going to be pretty difficult. So, but yeah, I have not seen any kind of projection. I think realistically that they would be prevalent that soon.
The headlight tests, they were done with low beams?
And high beams. We have separate, if you go to our website and you look up a vehicle, you can search by make, model, and year from our ratings page, and you can see all the results of the evaluations of the low beams and the high beams, how much glare they got, if they have too much glare, they got demerits, if they have the high beam assist.
So your rating was based on combined?
On all of that together.
Well, this has been fantastic, Dr. Agee. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.